Morning. Smart people don't tell themselves stupid lies. You're all smart, which means that the justifications, rationalizations, reasons, excuses you come up with for doing, for not doing things, oh, they're good. When you sit with your friends, you share a wine, they'll nod reassuringly at you and agree with you. But deep inside, you know when they're not true. Now, a while ago, John gave a really provocative sermon about what do we do about challenges in Syria, the Middle East, and other places. I had some thoughts about that, but not about political or policy-based solutions. That's kind of outside my realm. But more about the human interactions that produce those outcomes. And then it got me thinking about kind of congruency. We look to leaders to hold themselves to a higher standard and to somehow influence society. But what if the great lesson is it's the other way? What if those circumstances we talk about aren't just outcomes, but are symptoms? Symptoms of the way we as humans interact on a daily basis. What if they're mirrors that if we look really, really closely, we can see ourselves? What if those leaders can't change until we do? I'll give you a tough illustration. This is a true story. This teacher came into class and he started teaching his lesson. About 5 minutes in, the student comes in late. The teacher stops his lesson, looks at the kid, and just rips into him, up one side, down the other, berates him, says he'll be a failure, he'll never amount to anything, goes on and on. A few minutes in, he walks up, smiles, shakes the kid's hand, and says, "Thank you, James." And he comes to the front of the class, and he says, "I just stood here and abused one of your classmates. Every single one of you knew that everything I was doing was wrong and reprehensible. Not one of you did a single thing to stop me." Today we're going to study the Holocaust and how that was allowed to happen. Ouch, right? So maybe these tragedies that we look at are really extreme extensions of our own conduct. But with that comes a really great opportunity that we can explore them and actually perhaps achieve some growth. They're painful, but that's okay. C.S. Lewis said, "Pain is God's megaphone to rouse a deaf world." So what I'm going to talk about is something I call radical responsibility. Now, the root of the word radical, John tells me, is actually not, it's not about rebellion or revolution. It's actually about the source. It's the source of what you're being. That's the root of, it actually means root. And so what radical responsibility actually is, it's about taking 100% ownership, accountability, and responsibility for every single result in one's life. Not just some, but all of them. Doesn't mean taking blame, but it means taking responsibility for it. And that sometimes is tough. And one of the problems is our brains evolved to have certain biases that would help us survive, right? And to be included in the tribe or the clan so that we don't get kicked out. There's a number of these biases. There's a negativity bias. People actually look for danger. They feel fear and anger longer. There's a confirmation bias. There's a selection bias. When you watch the Super Bowl this afternoon, you're likely to see the other team commit more fouls than your team. There's something called the backslide effect. When you receive evidence contrary to your entrenched beliefs that you share, you're more likely to hold on to those beliefs stronger. That's, you see that on both sides of the climate change debate. And so these biases sit in. But here's the thing. When I said smart people don't tell themselves stupid lies, a lot of smart people say those biases don't apply to them. I'm smart, I'm self-aware, I can make informed decisions, I'm beyond that. Well, I want to test that theory. I'm going to show you a video here in a second. In this video, you're going to see two teams. One team wears white shirts, one team wears black shirts. They're in front of an elevator. They're passing basketballs around. Your job in this video, who's seen this before? Anyone? Okay, if you've seen it, don't give the answer away. Your job is to count the number of times the white-shirted players pass the basketball to each other. Now, there's a bunch of basketballs flying around, so here's what you want to see. It's only when a white-shirted player passes to another white-shirted player. If they bounce it on the ground to each other, that's a pass. If they bounce it off the wall to each other, that's a pass. If they bounce it on the ground to themselves, that's not a pass. All right, let's see how you do. All right, how many did you count? How many? 9, 10, 11, 14? Excellent. How many times did the gorilla beat its chest? How many times did the gorilla beat its chest? Watch the video again. Look for the gorilla. Right about now. How many of you saw the gorilla? Couple people, right? You're all smart people. You missed the gorilla. It was right in front of you. So there's two lessons out of this. One, you are subject to the same biases as everybody else. That's called selective attention. It's done all the time. So all the any rationalizations and all that other stuff doesn't apply to me, not so true. Right? Now the second part of this is we evolved to survive. We see danger, we feel fear, and that's healthy for individual survival, but maybe we're missing something. Maybe something right in front of us. Maybe the great spiritual teachers like Jesus, like Buddha, like Gandhi, like Lao Tse and others, that maybe they're trying to get us beyond just wanting to survive, but to thrive. And not in a material sense, but wanting to reach our full moral potential. If you look at the story of Jesus talking to the woman at the well, or the tax collector in the tree, or riding a donkey into town waving palm leaves at a politically volatile period, or Buddha's notions of suffering, or the First Nations concept of considering the impact of your actions 7 generations down the line. All those are lessons or invitations to sort of think beyond the norm of what's accepted in our society, to kind of get out of our assumptions, to elevate our own conduct so that we can elevate that of others. Now, but the problem is what it requires of us is to look at some gorillas, to see the gorillas that are getting in the way of doing that, things that we may be missing. So I'm going to point out a few gorillas, but before I do that, I actually want to go the other way and tell a story that actually perfectly reflects radical responsibility. Spoiler alert, for those who were here in the summer, this is a rerun, but with just a slightly different emphasis. So about 8.5 years ago, my mom died. She died of complications from an infection from an IV needle while fighting cancer. She'd been in the hospital for a while and been receiving really great care. I went in to see her one day, and there was a new doctor on the ward that was just leaving. And I had never seen her before. I walked in, my mom was in tears, my father was white, a friend of theirs looked like they got hit by a truck. And I said, "What happened?" And my mom is, I don't know, but it's worse than we thought. If I don't get through the next round of chemo, I'm not gonna make it. So I went out to the doctor, I said, "Did you run some new tests?" She says, "No." I said, "Did you get some new results?" She says, "No." I said, "Well, what was that?" And she says, and I quote, "Your mother cannot possibly understand how serious her condition is because," wait for it, "because she's too positive." Now, did I answer the call to elevation at that moment? No, I was probably as angry as I have ever been. But this is my mom. So I convince her that nothing new has happened. This is just somebody who doesn't know her. So the next day the doctor comes in and my mom says, "Do you have a minute to talk, dear?" And the doctor says, "Sure." And she says, I want to share something, that I have a treatment plan that's in addition to your treatment plan. And everyone involved in my care understands and accepts my part of the treatment plan. And my part of the treatment plan is to only have people around me who will be positive. Would that be okay?" And the doctor says, "Yes." Now, how does this tie to radical responsibility? If my mom had complained, everyone would have said she is justified, right? If she had asked for a new doctor, if she'd wanted a complaint to put on that doctor's file, no one would have said she was unreasonable. They would have said it was justifiable outrage. But here's the thing. It would not have produced the outcome that she wanted, right? Radical responsibility is saying, what do I do to produce the outcomes I want? And here's the important part in this context, regardless of the moral quality of the actions of someone else. It's about what do I do? Now the kryptonite to radical responsibility are this terrible trio of blame, excuse making, and denial. But the thing about smart people is they can engage in those trio but mask it under other things. And those are the gorillas. So I just want to talk about a few of the gorillas that smart people engage in. And the first is the conflation of responsibility with blame. It's really easy. Look, if I'm walking down the street and so I see a dog running loose with its leash dragging behind it, it's not my fault that the dog got away, right? And then if I look up and I see some truck run a red light and the guy looking at his phone, not paying attention, it's not my fault he's doing that and put the dog in danger. But if I have the ability to reach down and grab that dog's leash, I would argue it's my responsibility to do so, even though it's not my fault. But people mix up these two things all the time. And I think one of the big lies in media, in politics, and in our personal lives is that somehow the question who started it or who's at fault is somehow an important starting point. It's a lie. The most important starting question is who's going to be responsible to do something about it. But when these things get conflated, you get these really bizarre arguments that you hear all the time. Hey, nobody in my family history had slaves, so why do I have to do anything about it? Canada didn't bomb Iraq, why do we have to welcome refugees? Nobody I know had anything to do with the residential school system, so why should my taxes have to help repair it? These are kind of strange arguments that people make, but it happens all the time. And here's the thing where it gets confusing. Blame is backwards. Who did what? Responsibility is forward. Who will do what? That's the distinction. But it gets messed up. And think about it in your personal lives, which is really what this is about. I'm using politics as the metaphor. But in your personal lives, have you ever had a relationship where one of you said something like, well, if you hadn't have done that, I wouldn't have said this? What, just me? Yeah, it kind of happens all the time. What would happen in that relationship instead if both people sat across the table from each other and said, what can I do to make this better for both of us? How much better would a relationship be? That's radical responsibility. But one of the reasons this takes us to the second gorilla. Why don't people do that? There's something really interesting that's happened. Maybe it's always been the case. Maybe it's because we're in this digital age. But I find people are very binary, right? It's either this or this. You know, John made a really compelling argument in his sermon that the West has a high level of culpability for what's going on in the Middle East, right? Everything from colonially driven borders to the installing of dictators like the Shah and Saddam Hussein, right? But some people take that further and say because of those things, all the blame and responsibility is on the West. At the same time, I was listening to a social activist from the Middle East, and her argument, she's an Arab Muslim activist, and she was arguing that there's been intra-Muslim conflict for over 1,400 years. The States has only been around for less than 300, so there's no way we can lay blame at the doorstep of the United States. And I go, those are really interesting arguments, but why are they inconsistent? Why can there not be shared responsibility to these things? But people have a resistance to doing so. Excuse me. You know, and it happens in our personal lives as well, whether you know, it can be that kind of political stuff, like you hear it here all the time too, where it's like, well, those the chiefs on those reserves, they get paid so much money, as if somehow that abdicates us, frees us from our responsibility for what's happened. Or you left the vase in the wrong place, so somehow that's an excuse for me knocking it on the floor. Or mom messed me up rather than mom's actions and my reactions to mom's actions messed me up. Right? All those things apply. Now, why don't we want to engage in shared responsibility? That's the third gorilla. The third gorilla is acceptance of responsibility might have a cost associated with it. The lawyers get involved. There might be liability. And so we come up with, so what we tend to do is deflect and defend before we sit and listen and try to collaborate. And that, the other part of that shared responsibility, or the worry about cost, it's not just financial cost, but there's also the sort of pride cost, that somehow there's a loss of face in apologizing. You know, I sometimes in my work, I will actually recommend sometimes something I call strategic apology. And sometimes when I recommend it, I can see people actually start to short circuit. And they kind of go, well, but why should I apologize? They were wrong too. Yeah, they were. So what? Is making the apology going to produce a better outcome for you? But people kind of, they have a hard time doing that. But, and in any sort of political conflict where there's fights over territory, you're always going to see that there are two historically competing and wholly incompatible narratives. And neither is willing to give any legitimacy to the other narrative, and neither will accept that anything they've done is wrong despite the increasing body count. But on the other hand, you look at places where there have been things like truth and reconciliation commissions, and apology is not only therapeutic, it's productive. There's places in the States where hospitals have rejected lawyers' advice and have actually started apologizing for things. You know what happens? Litigation actually drops, declines. Think about it in your own personal life when you're in a conflict. If someone would actually acknowledge your feelings, acknowledge that maybe you have some reason to feel wronged, how much would the temperature come down? What if the person you're in conflict with may react the same way if you acknowledge theirs? So these are just some of the gorillas. There's a bunch more, but that's a starting point. But if you engage in radical responsibility, it becomes a muscle that you build that's sort of like, becomes a virtue. And I love the word virtue because it has another Greek origin. The origin of the word virtue is actually the Greek word arete. And arete is actually something closer to an excellence. And an excellence is something you achieve by practice and effort. You know, John talked to the kids this morning about that. It isn't enough just to read the book, it's to put it into practice. And so virtue is an excellence that is achieved through effort and practice and repetition. If you read Marcus Aurelius's Meditations, he was the Roman emperor, and he struggled mightily with concepts of morality and decision-making and humility and courage and strength for two reasons. One, because he knew it was really important, and secondly, because it's really hard. And it takes a lot of effort to get there. You know, the Navy SEALs have this great line. They say, you do not rise to the occasion, you sink to the level of your training. And if we don't train ourselves in this stuff, it becomes harder to do. There's a Confucian scholar named Wang Mangying, and he says, to know and not to act is not to know. In other words, if you don't live it, you don't know it. And I think this is one of the biggest challenges in modern Christianity, and frankly, a lot of other faiths as well. A lot of people know what's in the book, but they don't live it. When one of John's early sermons, which I thought was brilliant, he commented about how Emperor Julian tried to revert the empire back to paganism, but was unsuccessful because of Christian kindness. Christians were supporting people, they were welcoming, they were helping. They would bring in travelers that no one else would assist. Now we have Christian leaders wanting to reject refugees. In Canada, we had a government, and this isn't a political thing about left or right, but the fact is we had a government that did not accept any of the recommendations of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. We are not training ourselves in acceptance of radical responsibility, and it requires some effort in doing so. So, in terms of what we can do at the individual level to accept radical responsibility, there's a couple things. At the political level, I think one thing is if we should reject leaders of any party, ours or anybody else's, and at any level, who offer us the gift of excuses. And I don't mean excuses for their conduct, I mean excuses for ours. When people give you a way out, when people give you excuses, here's why it bugs me, it's insulting. Because anyone who gives you excuses thinks you weak. They think you're not capable to answer a demand for a higher standard. But people who challenge you, they respect you. They think you're capable. Those are the ones who say, let's put someone on the moon. We can actually build an economy and make it clean as well. We have the strength and morality to reconcile our relationships with First Nations. We can make these changes. We have the ability to compete at an international level. Now, at an individual level, we also have to be careful about the excuses we offer. The excuses we offer to other people, and the excuses we offer to ourselves. Realize we have to accept that courage doesn't reject fear, it overcomes it. Joy does not eliminate pain, but is nourished by it. Humility doesn't abdicate leadership, it injects wisdom into it. And love doesn't just forgive injustice and give comfort to its victims, it seeks to remedy its causes. You know, at home we have a little sign on our fridge, and it's a single question. And I actually think the attempt to answer this question is one of the greatest ways of building the muscle or of training ourselves, to use the Navy SEALs language, in radical responsibility. It's a very simple question, and its simplicity masks its complexity and application. And the question is this: what would love do? And I think that's everything I'm talking about today about radical responsibility is distilled down to that. Now, sometimes when I pose that question to people, they think it's kind of mushy and squishy, right? But it's actually, if you look at how it's applied, if you look at Jesus, who actually lived the answer to that question in the most uncompromising way I know, you realize how unbelievably demanding and hard, but ultimately transformative it can be. And when we actually attempt to live that answer, then I think we are able to sort of elevate ourselves away from kind of our evolution-installed instincts and start to have the impacts that are envisioned by Gandhi's oft-quoted but often misunderstood plea to be the change you want to see in the world. Thanks for considering my thoughts. Thank you.